Welcome to Dermatologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Carl Lewis, and to get a better understanding of where we stand currently with systemic treatment of melanoma, and also emerging data on basal cell carcinoma and a bit on squamous cell carcinoma, I asked Dr. Lewis to present patients from his practice. And to begin, he told me about a 34-year-old woman who was first diagnosed with a Clark's level 4 superficial spreading melanoma, 1.4 millimeters in thickness on her right knee in 2006, followed by a 9-centimeter inguinal nodal recurrence treated with intensive biochemotherapy followed by surgical excision. She did well for 2 years after that, but then presented with disease recurrence.
In March of 2010, she developed headaches, and an MRI of the brain unfortunately revealed CNS metastasis. One of these was rather large and hemorrhagic and required craniotomy. The other lesion was smaller and treated with stereotactic radiosurgery. At that time, she had no systemic disease. She did well for a couple of months. In August of 2010, on surveillance MRI, she developed another subcentimeter CNS lesion, and that was treated with gamma knife therapy. And then a few months later, in December of 2010, after a trip visiting her family, she was flying back to Colorado and developed severe headache and mental status changes on the airplane and was taken to the emergency department at the University of Colorado, and she was found to have a large intraparenchymal hemorrhage. She developed hydrocephalus. She required a shunt. She underwent craniotomy with resection of that mass and evacuation of the hemorrhage. And unfortunately, at that time, CT showed multiple large hepatic metastases, as well as what looked like bony metastasis and a small lung lesion. So her steroids were tapered as rapidly as possible, and at that time, we started her on a compassionate use protocol of ipilimumab, a CTLA-4 antibody, and her first infusion was in December of 2010.
Just to clarify, at the time she started, was she still on steroids, and how much of a concern are steroids?
She was off steroids at that time because there is a concern that initiating ipilimumab in a patient on steroids may abrogate some of the immunologic effects. So she was off steroids.
How long do you like people to be off?
There's no data. Obviously, as long as possible, but in certain situations, you know, your hand is kind of forced. And in this situation, she had rapidly progressive disease and she was quite symptomatic. In terms of having severe abdominal pain and her performance status was not the best. What was due to her systemic disease versus her severe CNS disease was a little bit difficult to fish out, but she was not in a good situation.
So what happened?
So she received 4 ipilimumab infusions, completing treatment in March of 2011, and a repeat CT scan at that time showed marked improvement in her systemic disease. She had resolution of her lung lesions, and a significant decrease in her tumor burden in her liver. And she has been followed since that time and has been doing remarkably well. Her last scans were just a few weeks ago. She had very small but stable liver lesions, and she has not progressed in the CNS since receiving the ipilimumab.
How often do you see objective responses like this with ipilimumab?
Well, the objective response rates are relatively low. They're probably somewhere in the order of around 10 to 20%. So response rates are not very high with this agent. And that's one of the problems is you're treating a patient like this who is symptomatic from her systemic disease, and you're using an agent that doesn't have that great of a track record in terms of shrinking her disease. But you can see it, and she is one of the patients who did receive a meaningful objective response.
And what about side effects and tolerability?
She tolerated very well. The side effects to ipilimumab in general are immunologic side effects. The way ipilimumab works, it binds CTLA-4, which is a repressor of T cells. So basically, the best analogy is you're removing the brakes of the immune system. And so the side effects can be profound immunologic side effects. The big ones are skin and GI. The GI side effects are the most concerning because people can develop very significant colitis. And in the early studies, it was actually perforation of the bowel and some deaths due to ipilimumab. She had some mild pruritus associated with the treatment, and she also developed hypothyroidism. And endocrinopathies are a known side effect of this agent as well.
She had hypothyroidism clinically or just serologically?
Clinically, she was developing fatigue. About 6 months after treatment, her TSH was checked and it was elevated. So she was started on thyroid supplementation and is doing fine from that standpoint.
What was the BRAF mutation status?
She is BRAF wild type.
If she had been mutated, would you still have used Ipi?
In this case, probably not. Because her disease was so rapidly progressive, we probably would have favored using a BRAF inhibitor in that situation, because those have shown in clinical studies to have much higher response rates and control of very symptomatic disease quickly.
Can you talk a little bit more about the GI problems that are seen with ipilimumab and how they're managed?
Well, the GI problems generally manifest as diarrhea. And if it's relatively mild, they can be managed with some anti-motility agents. If they become moderate, you often have to put patients on steroids. And certainly if they become severe, that is more than 7 stools a day, bloody diarrhea, patients absolutely need steroids. One of the problems in the initial trials was that this was a little bit slow to be recognized, and so patients progressed with the colitis and developed perforation. And we actually had a patient on an adjuvant study of CTLA-4 antibody that died from a bowel perforation. So early initiation of steroids is very important.
And then you reinstitute treatment?
In some situations you can. So if the diarrhea is relatively mild, can be controlled on a short course of taperine steroids, you can reinitiate ipilimumab with caution. If they develop severe colitis, then they cannot receive additional ipilimumab. There are very good algorithms that have been worked out and are supplied by the company in terms of how to manage these side effects.
What other problems are seen with this agent? I heard about hypopituitarism.
Yeah, so you can get a hypophysitis. That's fortunately relatively rare. We've seen a few cases, and patients can present with some very vague symptoms, so fatigue, low-grade headaches, some eye pressure, and you can diagnose that with MRI. You see an inflammation of the pituitary on MRI imaging. An endocrine workup reveals that they've developed panhypopituitarism.
And what else is seen with the drug?
As I mentioned earlier, one of the most common side effects is cutaneous side effects, generally manifesting as a rash. And a lot of people develop this. It can be very severe, ranging to Stevens-Johnson syndrome and life-threatening, but most of them it's just pruritus and managed with topical treatments. Some patients do require pulses of systemic steroids to control that symptom, and that is the most common.
You mentioned adjuvant trials. Can you talk a little bit about what kinds of trials are being done with this agent, not just in the adjuvant setting, but in general?
One of the more interesting trials is that it is starting to be combined with vemurafenib, a BRAF inhibitor. And that's going to be a very important study to see if we can obviously have the benefit of the response rate from the BRAF inhibitor and then the durability that the immunotherapy will supply. So that trial is early on, but actively accruing patients. And then it is being looked at in the adjuvant setting currently as well. ECOG has a study right now that is randomizing patients between ipilimumab and high-dose interferon, and that's a very important study to get finished as well.
If the drug had been available at the time that she had that local recurrence and needed the biochemotherapy and the surgery, would you have considered it as part of that therapy, either before surgery or after?
Well, after surgery, that would have been an adjuvant situation, and the drug's not approved adjuvantly currently.
What would you have said her chance of metastatic disease was at that point?
At the time of her initial presentation with that large nodal mass, her chance of developing metastatic disease in the future was significant, probably on the order of 70% or so. So she was in a very high-risk group.
What do we know about ipilimumab and CNS mets?
That's very interesting. We think that there is some immunologic penetration and that patients are getting benefit in the CNS. A number of years ago, Dr. Hody published a case report where a brain lesion was resected after a patient received CTLA-4 antibody and saw CD8 infiltration around those melanoma cells. And there's some small series and anecdotal reports of patients having shrinkage of brain metastasis. And in this case here, she was developing rapidly progressive brain disease, brain metastasis after brain metastasis. And since she responded to the ipilimumab, her brain has remained clear. So there hopefully and probably is some immune penetration into the CNS.
Now, if a patient were to ask you who's about to start ipilimumab, what's the chance that I'm going to benefit from treatment? How would you answer it?
Well, the way that I counsel patients when we talk about ipilimumab, I really use the analogy that it's either a home run or a strikeout. And unfortunately, most people with this drug do strike out. There's about a 20% long-term survival rate with this agent. And that's significant. I mean, there is a significant number of patients who can benefit from it, but unfortunately, most patients who receive it do not derive the benefit we're looking for. This is a bit of an unusual case with ipilimumab. The best candidates for this drug are generally those that have a relatively low burden of disease or not symptomatic from their disease because the immunologic responses can be delayed. And so this is a bit of an unusual situation where she was very symptomatic, had rapidly progressive disease, but still responded to the immunotherapy. It does happen, but it's not the common situation.
Any tissue predictors or, you know, assays that predict who's going to benefit from treatment? Anything being worked on or theorized?
Well, there's a lot of work going into this, but unfortunately, no information that we have now to be clinically useful. So you have to treat everybody in hopes of them being in that 20% or so that get that long-term benefit. But right now, there's no clinical method we have to identify the responders.
Any speculations, for example, whether or not it's sort of the host system, so to speak, or the tumor?
Well, my speculation is that it's the host system. And we know patients can develop immunity to melanoma. It's been long known that patients often develop vitiligo, and that may be a good prognostic feature of some melanoma patients. So the body on its own can recognize this tumor. It's just a matter of trying to harness that and increase the likelihood that that's going to happen.
What is known or what's being looked at in terms of ipilimumab and other tumors? I remember seeing a report in lung cancer. Anything encouraging in any other tumor?
Well, I know it's being looked at in prostate cancer. It's been looked at in lung cancer with not too encouraging results. Renal cell cancer would be another good candidate because it's traditionally another tumor type that can be treated with immunotherapy. But certainly most of the data at this point in time, most of the positive data is in melanoma.
Let's talk about your second case, the 32-year-old woman.
So my second case is a 32-year-old female. She presented to me in November of 2008. And she had a history of a primary melanoma that dated back to July of 2003, and this was a Clark's level 4, 1.4 millimeter thick melanoma. And this was treated with wide excision and a sentinel lymph node biopsy, which was negative. She did well for about 5 years when she developed a frontal skull metastasis as well as liver metastasis. And at that time, she elected to seek care in Mexico and alternative therapy in Mexico. But she rapidly progressed and re-presented to her outside oncologist a couple of months later. And her outside oncologist started biochemotherapy, and she received her first cycle at an outside hospital. After that cycle, she transferred her care to us, and since she had already initiated the biochemotherapy, we decided to continue with that treatment, and she received a total of 4 cycles of biochemotherapy, and she actually had a complete response in terms of her systemic disease. And she finished treatment in about May of 2009. However, shortly thereafter, she developed brain metastasis, and these were treated with stereotactic radiosurgery. And then in January of 2010, she developed rapidly progressive systemic disease with multiple subcutaneous metastasis and a massive pelvic metastasis. And she had significant abdominal distension and discomfort from that tumor mass. She was found to have a BRAF mutation, and she was treated with femurafenib on a clinical trial, and she had a marked and rapid reduction in her tumor, and she was doing quite well for a number of months. And then about a year into the femurafenib therapy, she developed rapidly progressive disease and shortly thereafter died from her melanoma.
How did she tolerate femurafenib, and what do you see in terms of side effects and tolerability with the agent?
She tolerated the femurafenib fairly well. She did have some lowering of her blood counts, which required a dose reduction a few months into her treatment, although we were able to get her back up to full dose femurafenib. She did have some skin toxicity as well, She had some rash associated with it. She did have some arthralgia, so she had a lot of the common side effects that you see with that agent.
What kind of rash is it, and what do you do about it?
Well, it's kind of treat it symptomatically. It can be a macular rash.
So like a TKI type rash? You know, facial acne-like?
Not quite. So the MEK inhibitor is another class that targets this MAP kinase pathway. You can get that classic acneiform rash. This is more of a diffuse, generalized rash. And she was treated symptomatically for that. You can also develop some hyperkeratotic lesions. And she did develop some of those as well. And most of the patients that I have on vemurafenib, I do ask them to follow with dermatology because cutaneous side effects are a very common problem with this agent.
What about squamous cancers?
Now, she did not develop any squamous cancers while on vemurafenib, but that is very commonly reported, and a number of our patients have developed squamous cell carcinomas. So it is a very significant side effect of this agent.
The patients that you've seen, where were the lesions, and what do they look like?
Well, they're sort of raised nodular lesions, and they can develop rather quickly. They're generally on chronically sun-exposed areas, so head, upper trunk, and treated with simple excision, which is why dermatology evaluation in these patients, I think, is very important.
Can you talk about what we know about how this agent works and then why it might increase this risk of squamous cancers?
Well, vemurafenib is a very specific blocker of BRAF, of mutated BRAF, and BRAF is mutated in about 50% of melanomas. So it's a very good target in this disease. And the responses that we've seen to this agent have been very dramatic and very rapid. So it's really a game changer in terms of treating metastatic melanoma in that 50% of patients who have a BRAF mutation. Does have side effects, though, and a lot of those side effects are cutaneous side effects, one of them commonly being development of squamous cell carcinomas. Now, it's thought that these squamous cell carcinomas develop in keratinocytes that already harbor RAS mutations. So they have normal BRAF, but they have an underlying RAS mutation. And that somehow blocking of the normal BRAF with the BRAF inhibitors then allows hyperproliferation of those cells with the RAS mutation, resulting in squamous cell carcinomas.
What do we know about the mechanisms of resistance to vemurafenib, and what kinds of research ideas are out there to try to deal with it?
Well, that's the hot area of research currently. We're starting to identify certain mechanisms of resistance, and it's very important because the response rates are so dramatic, like we've never seen before in melanoma, but unfortunately the progression-free survival is on the order of about 7 months. And patients then can progress rapidly after they develop resistance to this agent. So finding the way that the tumor is becoming resistant to this agent is very important. Now, it looks like there's reactivation of the MAP kinase pathway in a lot of the tumors that have become resistant, so maybe dual blockade with a BRAF inhibitor plus a MEK inhibitor. There's also data out there suggesting that there's alternative pathways that are activated, such as the PI3 kinase pathway. So maybe continuing to block the MAP kinase pathway with adding PI3 kinase blockers. Various trials like that are currently being designed and are going to be a very important next step in how this agent is used.
Are there adjuvant trials out there of vemurafenib, and where are they?
There is an adjuvant trial that's in the works. It's going to be a randomized trial of high-risk melanoma patients that harbor a BRAF mutation. They're going to be randomized between vemurafenib versus placebo. So the study's in the works. It's not enrolling currently.
Now, what about post-vemurafenib treatment? What about ipilimumab? For example, in this patient, was that considered?
Well, unfortunately, she progressed rather rapidly and died. But we actually were considering trying to initiate her on ipilimumab. So ipilimumab is approved for first-line metastatic melanoma, second-line metastatic melanoma, so it would have been certainly appropriate in a situation where a patient is progressing on a BRAF inhibitor.
What are the other systemic therapies that you'll consider in patients who progress on vemurafenib or ipilimumab for that matter?
Well, right now for patients who are progressing on vemurafenib, trying to get them on a clinical trial with other targeted agents is very important. So there's some trials that have been done as well as trials that are going on now that are looking at adding MEK inhibitors to patients progressing on vemurafenib. So, you know, trying to find other targeted approaches to control the tumor are what's important at this point.
Anything new in terms of trials evaluating more traditional approaches to melanoma, including chemotherapy?
There was a study that was recently completed that was randomized between DTIC chemotherapy, the standard chemotherapy for lack of a better agent, versus nab-paclitaxel based on some encouraging phase 2 data. But until that comes out, it's something that we're not using off of protocol.
Anything else you want to say about vemurafenib?
Well, targeting mutated BRAF is something that is really, as I said, a game changer in melanoma. So you have vemurafenib, you have another compound called dabrafenib that is showing encouraging results. And it's a matter now of really trying to work out what the resistant mechanisms are, what other mutations these tumors may have, how can we add different targeted therapies to make these responses more durable. And certainly it's a very exciting time for melanoma with these targeted agents such as vemurafenib.
How do you approach the patient with a BRAF mutation? Do you always start with vemurafenib or is ipilimumab a consideration first?
That's an excellent question. And there is really no data out there that I know of that tells us what the right answer in that situation is. So I think you have to look at it individually. If you have a patient that has relatively low burden of disease, they are not symptomatic from their disease, and they're otherwise a good candidate for immunotherapy, it's a discussion that I think you absolutely need to have with the patient, which is to say, look, we have an immunotherapy that has a low chance of working, but if it does work for you, there's a chance that it could be very, very durable, lasting many years. And then we would have the vemurafenib as second line. The alternative is if you have a patient that's rapidly progressive, very symptomatic, doesn't have a lot of time to wait for the response that may come about from CTLA-4 antibodies, then vemurafenib is probably more appropriate first line.
How do you approach the issue of high-dose interleukin any differently today than you did before these two agents came out?
We give a lot of high-dose IL-2 at our center. And in my mind, the positive studies with the ipilimumab were validation of immunotherapy in this disease. Now, the interleukin-2 certainly has not been looked at in a randomized setting. There's no evidence that in a randomized trial that it would result in a survival benefit, but certainly there's enough anecdotal reports out there of long-term survivors with that agent. Therefore, I tend to think high-dose IL-2 is still a valid treatment option. When I talk to a patient about immunotherapy using ipilimumab or IL-2, it's a matter of sequencing the two agents. There doesn't seem to be any data that if a patient fails IL-2, they will not respond to ipilimumab or vice versa. So which one do you give up front? My practice has been to sort of think about doing the IL-2 first, because the ipilimumab, there's a small percentage of patients who can end up on long-term immunosuppressive corticosteroid doses from their immunologic effects. And if that patient happens to progress on ipilimumab, is on steroids, then they are no longer a candidate for IL-2. So we will often give the IL-2 up front, save the ipilimumab for second line.
Anything new? And it seems like for a long time we've tried to look for serologic or predictors of benefit from IL-2. Anything new or encouraging there?
Unfortunately, it's the same discussion with the ipilimumab, not currently. We do not have a way to adequately categorize which patients will have a better shot of responding to those immunologic agents.
Okay, let's talk about your 68-year-old lady.
So the next case is a 68-year-old female who had not had routine medical care for many, many years. And for about 4 years prior to her presentation, she was developing a growing mass on the frontal parietal scalp. And this started to ulcerate and bleed, and she was obviously concerned about this in a cosmetic sense, and so she was covering up with a wig. And finally, at the insistence of her husband, she sought medical evaluation, and a biopsy was consistent with basal cell carcinoma. On clinical evaluation, she had a very large, about 10 by 10 centimeter necrotic and bleeding mass on the scalp. CT scan did not show any underlying bone involvement, and she presented to our clinic for treatment options. So she was started on a clinical trial of vismodegib, which is an inhibitor of the hedgehog pathway. And she had a rapid and marked decrease in her tumor mass. She did have some side effects of the therapy, the most common side effects of those agents in general. She seemed to have most of those, which were taste alteration, weight loss, muscle cramping, and alopecia. She was on treatment for about 6 months when she elected to discontinue the vismodegib secondary to side effects of the treatment. And we did scouting biopsies at that time and pathologically showed scar. There was no identifiable basal cell carcinoma that we could see. And she has now been off drug for about 1 year's time and has had no evidence of recurrence of that basal cell carcinoma.
Can you talk a little bit about where surgery fits in with these patients in general, and what about in this lady?
Well, surgery is really the standard in basal cell carcinoma because fortunately most basal cell carcinomas are found small and are easily amenable to some sort of local therapy, either excision, either treatment with Mohs micrographic surgery or local destructive therapy. So surgery certainly is the first thing that should be thought of. However, unfortunately, some of these are extensively locally advanced and are really not amenable to surgical resection.
So this lady's response with seems like a pathologic CR, how common or uncommon is that?
Well, pathologic CRs are not extremely common, although they do happen. And she was one that did have a pathologic CR. The studies that are looking at treating locally advanced and metastatic basal cell carcinoma with vismodegib has shown very encouraging response rates. And the recent abstract presented at the EADO meeting this past summer showed a investigator-assessed response rate in locally advanced basal cell carcinomas of around 60%. There was independent confirmation of that response rate, and it was somewhere around 45%. So there is a very high response rate with this agent in this disease.
And what about this issue of discontinuing treatment? Do you often or ever see these situations, as in this lady, where you stop treatment and yet the tumor doesn't come back?
We have seen it in a couple of cases. So a few of the patients that I was treating did end up with pathologic complete responses and are doing well off of therapy.
Can you talk a little bit about what we know about the mechanism of action of this drug and how it ties into the pathophysiology of this disease?
Well, the mechanism of vismodegib is it's a small molecule inhibitor of a protein called smoothin. And smoothin is in this so-called hedgehog pathway. And the hedgehog pathway is important in embryogenesis and development. And it's a series of proteins. So there's a cell surface protein called patched, which has actually an inhibitory effect on smoothin. And when patch binds hedgehog ligand, that inhibitory effect is removed, smoothin is activated, then stimulates downstream transcription effectors such as GLI1, and you have gene transcription and cellular proliferation. And in almost all basal cell carcinomas, there's an abnormality in this hedgehog pathway. Most of the abnormalities are found in the patch gene. About 80% have patch mutations. There is about 20% that ends up with smoothin mutations. And this was actually elucidated in patients who have basal cell nevus syndrome, which is an autosomally dominant inherited disease where patients can develop hundreds of basal cell carcinomas as well as other abnormalities. And it was found that it was actually an inherited germline mutation in patch that led to this. And sure enough, sporadic basal cell carcinomas can have the same mutations.
When you see patients with advanced disease, is it generally in the situation of, you know, not getting medical therapy, or do you ever see people actually develop in spite of the fact that they're having close medical treatment?
It is both. So certainly in this situation, this was a lack of medical care. This was a lesion that could have, in all likelihood, been treated very successfully if she would have sought dermatologic evaluation early on. But she let it get to this point where it was not amenable to resection. But we do see patients who do have very aggressive and locally advanced disease in the setting of very adequate medical care. And it just happens to be patients who have basal cell carcinomas arising in unfortunate situations. So they're often tracking into the orbit, tracking into the nasal canal. And surgery after surgery after surgery is just not able to clear those. So those are patients who also a drug like this would be very effective or potentially effective.
How often do you see metastasis?
Rarely. So this is a disease that very, very rarely metastasizes. The exact incidence of metastatic disease in basal cell carcinoma is poorly defined, so we don't know the exact incidence. It's thought to be less than 0.5% of patients who develop basal cell carcinomas will develop metastasis, and there really, up to this point, has not been an effective therapy for either locally advanced or metastatic disease.
When patients die from basal cell, what are some of the syndromes that they have? How do they die?
Well, sometimes they can die from local extension of their tumor, and other times they can die from metastatic disease, just as any other patient would. The most common sites of metastasis for basal cell carcinoma seem to be lymph nodes, lung, and bone.
Can you talk a little bit more about the side effects that are seen with this agent and how they're managed?
The side effects seem to be universal across these categories of hedgehog inhibitors. And two of the most problematic are taste alteration and muscle cramping, because these severely affect patients' day-to-day quality of life. And this patient had both of those side effects. So patients develop, after a couple of months of therapy, just an inability to taste food. And they do have weight loss as another side effect. But whether the weight loss is due to the taste alteration or to some other mechanism, it's not clear. In my mind, it probably is due to the taste alteration. They just don't enjoy food and are not eating. And then muscle cramping is another big problem. So patients will complain, you know, in the middle of the night, they'll just stretch a little bit and develop severe and debilitating muscle cramps. And this is something that we often have to hold the dose of the medication, let these side effects sort of work themselves out, and then restart them on the therapy.
So both the taste and the muscle cramping are reversible?
They are reversible when you stop the drug.
What's going on right now in terms of further research on this drug as well as this strategy?
Well, I think a very important next step in this drug, just like most targeted therapies, is to find out what the escape mechanisms are for the tumor, because you can see responses and then the tumor starts to grow in the face of the drug. And we're not clear at all why that happens, whether it's alternative mutations in smoothing, upregulation of alternative pathways. We really have no idea at this point in time. So that's a very important research topic. There are other trials being done to sort of look to see if we can make some of the larger tumors that are borderline resectable, given this drug is sort of in a neoadjuvant approach, to shrink these tumors down, make them amenable to resection. And there's an active trial going on currently. Also, this drug is being looked at in patients with basal cell nevus syndrome. So basal cell nevus syndrome patients have abnormalities in the hedgehog signaling pathway. So they're a very appropriate population for a drug like this. And studies out of Stanford have shown that patients with basal cell nevus syndrome treated with vismodegib develop less basal cell carcinomas over time than those treated with a placebo. The problem, of course, is that that's a germline mutation, and they're going to require lifelong therapy with this drug. So, you know, with the side effects, how do you manage their quality of life with an agent like this versus development of basal cell carcinoma? So is an intermittent approach of this drug appropriate? And those are some questions that need answered.
Any predictors or response with this agent?
We're not doing currently tumor analysis prior to treatment. And the reason is that well over 90% of basal cell carcinomas have this defect. So the likelihood is that it's there, it's a targetable defect, and hopefully there'll be responders to the therapy.
How many cases a year are there of patients with locally advanced or metastatic basal cell?
That is not known. The numbers on that are somewhat of a mystery. Certainly, this is a disease that has generally been out of the realm of the medical oncologist simply because we didn't have any effective therapies for it. And up till we had the trials with the hedgehog inhibitors, I really wasn't seeing patients with locally advanced basal cell carcinoma. But once the word got out that there was a drug that was potentially effective in this disease, you know, patients started to show up. So what the true incidence is really unknown. It's a minority of the population with basal cell carcinomas, but that being said, it certainly is a disease that desperately needs an effective therapy, and this looks like a good start to that.
Any other tumors or diseases that hedgehog inhibitors or vismodegib seems likely, you know, maybe going to be tested in?
Well, medulloblastoma is a CNS tumor that has abnormalities in the hedgehog pathway, and there are some early reports of some good responses vismodegib in that disease setting, so that's certainly something that's very exciting. It's also being looked at in a number of different cancers, such as pancreatic cancer, but those data are probably less exciting.
Let's talk about your last case, the 52-year-old woman.
So a 52-year-old woman with a renal transplant secondary to a congenital kidney malformation, she had been followed with occasional squamous cell carcinomas of her skin resected in the past, and she was referred to me a few years ago for evaluation of a primary melanoma that was diagnosed on her scalp. And this was a Clark's level 4, 2.2 millimeter thick melanoma, and that was treated with wide excision and a sentinel lymph node biopsy, which was negative. So I was following her clinically for that melanoma when on routine examination she was noted to have a palpable left axillary mass, and a PET CT scan at that time showed a solitary hypermetabolic lymph node. A biopsy of that lymph node was consistent with squamous cell carcinoma. She had no identifiable primary in that region that would suggest that that was a local metastasis, but she had extensive sun damage. We just could never identify a squamous cell carcinoma in that location. She underwent complete lymph node dissection, and she did well for approximately 3 months when she presented with severe and progressive abdominal pain. And a PET CT scan showed multiple liver metastases as well as intra-abdominal and retroperitoneal lymph nodes. And obviously the concern was, you know, is this melanoma or is this squamous cell carcinoma? So these were biopsied, and they were pathologically consistent with metastatic squamous cell carcinoma. She was treated with single-agent cetuximab. She had a very poor performance status by this point in time, and she had been unable to tolerate chemotherapy. She did clinically deteriorate rapidly on the cetuximab, and she died away within 6 weeks of that presentation.
What do we know about the pathophysiology of squamous cell carcinoma in these patients with transplant?
It's not entirely clear, although we do know that squamous cell carcinoma has a much higher incidence in immunosuppressed patients than in immunocompetent patients. Whether that's due to decreased immune surveillance or some other mechanism is not clear, but the incidence certainly is higher in this group.
What about immune suppressive agents? What do you do about that when the patient develops a squamous cell?
You try to decrease the immunosuppression as much as possible. And whether it has to do with the type of immunosuppressive agent, such as cyclosporin versus rapamycin, there's some data out there to suggest that that may be important, with cyclosporin having a higher risk. It's not really clear. So basically just trying to decrease the immunosuppression as far as you can go while maintaining the kidney function.